readable, but would anyone mind if we left the lights on unless you can't see the slides? All right, it is after lunch, and this way I can heckle people who are sleeping. Okay, well, thank you. Thanks so much, Kurt, for inviting me to be here today. It's a real pleasure, and I have many questions after your talk, actually. And let me get back to the beginning of mine. Hold on. Uh-oh. How do I just start over? There we go. All right. So we have a short amount of time to cover a big issue. Let me just start at the beginning by saying we don't know anything about the sustainability of Miscanthus giganteus. Not really. It's a fairly new crop. For those of you who were here for Ken Vogel's presentation earlier today, hopefully someday we'll have that body of information. We will have that body of information for Miscanthus, but right now we don't. So I'm going to give you some things to consider, and I'm going to focus specifically on some aspects of sustainability. I'm not going to try to cover the breadth of the topic in this amount of time. Okay, so I used pictures here in addition to words because there's so many aspects of sustainability that you can't really try to describe them all. So what I'm going to talk about mainly today is yield as a component of sustainability. I'm also going to talk about water relations and nutrient cycling, specifically nitrogen cycling, so maybe we can get at some of the comments that were just addressed in the previous session. Before I do that, though, I want to say a little bit about Miscanthus and specifically what I'm going to mean when I say Miscanthus today, because it can mean a lot of different things. So first of all, I just wanted to start off by saying there was an excellent paper in Global Change Biology Bioenergy earlier this year by Stewart et al., giving a summary of the history of Miscanthus, and it's not a new crop. It's not at all a new crop. In fact, it's probably one of the oldest cultivated crops around. This is a picture of annual burning of a Miscanthus sinensis grassland in Japan that came out of that article. And there's massive grasslands in Japan that are managed this way, and here we're talking specifically about Miscanthus sinensis. I think it's interesting to note that traditionally, Miscanthus has been used both for forage and for building materials. And just think about that if you have kind of a forage background. You know, you don't eat something you build with. So if you think about the composition of this material, it's very different, right? You know, you don't eat wood, but we build with wood. So I think it just highlights the diversity of quality that we're going to see in the Miscanthus genus. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about today is specifically Miscanthus giganteus. And Miscanthus giganteus is a naturally occurring hybrid of Miscanthus sinensis that I just showed in the previous slide. Common ornamental, I mean, you probably all have it in your gardens or at least on your campus. It's a diploid species, and it naturally crossed with Miscanthus saccharophloris, a tetraploid species. And the hybrid produced is a sterile triploid. So far, the sterility of this triploid seems solid. There haven't been any documented incidents of overcoming the sterility of this hybrid, no natural chromosome doubling to my knowledge. And in fact, attempts to recreate this hybrid have been largely unsuccessful at improving on the original cross. It's not an easy one to make, and so far the naturally occurring giganteus has been every bit as productive as ones that have been created by man. So it still gets a lot of attention. The seeded varieties, Damien tells us, will be here anytime, I'm sure. But in the meantime, giganteus still has a lot of opportunity for use in the U.S. It's a real pain to plant, as Kurt just alluded to. So because it's sterile, you have two main planting options. You can plant by rhizome pieces, or you can plant by greenhouse-grown plugs. Both of them are costly, both of time, labor, and of money. For rhizomes, you have to go dig a mother stand. It's just a difficult operation for which we don't have optimized equipment yet. And plugs have to be planted live plants, so irrigation is required if you're going to put these things in the ground. So it's a huge pain, but once planted, a stand can last 30 or more years. So, you know, everything's front-loaded with giganteus. It may be worth it. That's yet to be determined. Just a little bit about the way the stand develops. In the first year, the crop is not usually harvested. This says switchgrass here, and this says Miscanthus. This is the meter stick right here in the first year. So it's not usually harvested, and weed control is essential in the first year. And that's because, as I said, the propagules are very expensive. And so generally, you plant one about every 3 feet, so on 3 foot centers and 1 meter centers, with the idea that it's going to fill in. So why would you spend a lot of extra money on these expensive propagules when it's going to fill in over time anyway? Well, the amount of time that it takes to fill in can vary from 2 to 5 years, depending on where you are. And I think an aspect of sustainability that's important, but I'm not going to cover it today, but something that we are working on at Iowa State, is to understand what we can do to kind of cover this ground area in the meantime. Because if we're talking about planting this stuff on marginal lands, oftentimes that means highly erodible land. Maybe not, but oftentimes there's a slope involved. And if we put a plant every 3 feet and then wait 5 years to fill in, there might not be much carbon left on that field for us to worry about. But again, competition with a plant that can cost $10,000 an acre to put in the ground, you don't really want to be planting your weeds as a cover crop. So it's going to be a little bit of a balance. Okay, so in years 2 through 4, the crop sort of builds, the yields increase over time. Weed control becomes gradually less necessary. The Miscanthus canopy emerges, well, it emerges in early spring and closes canopy very rapidly. So weeds don't really have an opportunity to compete with the crop, especially not once you get into an established stand. From years 3 to 5 on, the yields maintain fairly steady. Where might Giganteus be adapted? This is a broad growing range map that is just sort of my hypothesis. And to my mind, the biggest things that are going to control where we grow Giganteus, in the U.S. at least, as we move north, I think the biggest issue is going to be overwinter survival in the first year. So far, at least my experience has been that if it lives through the first year, you're golden. If it doesn't make it through the first year, no one's going to spend the money to plant it again. So overwinter survival in that first year is probably going to be critical for Miscanthus success and will largely determine where it grows. As you move south in the U.S., I think Giganteus becomes comparatively disadvantaged to some of our other more tropical species, so energy cane, other Miscanthus varieties, Napier grass will outcompete Giganteus. I don't really see Giganteus in the western half of the United States. Maybe irrigated agriculture, someday it will be profitable, but I don't know. I think water and growing season length are going to determine the growing range of Giganteus. And here's the reason we're talking about Giganteus today. This is a harvestable dry matter on the y-axis, and then an average of some plot yields of Miscanthus and switchgrass. And Miscanthus just wins every time that we've looked at it. So to my mind, this is one of the biggest issues with sustainability, because you know, high yields from Miscanthus should mean that we require less land, to meet our renewable energy goals, allowing cropland and natural land to do what they do. So hopefully we have less competition between food and fuel if you use high-yielding crops. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to talk a little bit about nutrient cycling, in particular to get at this nitrogen issue. So the thing about nitrogen, in Europe there's been a big conflicting body of literature on the nitrogen requirements of the crop. And most, you know how funding works. You get 3 years to answer a question that really takes about 10 or 15. So 3-year funding cycles have not been helpful to answer this question. But at Rothamsted, they've been growing, Rothamsted in the UK, they've been growing Miscanthus giganteus under 3 nitrogen regimes for 15 years now. And this has been an interesting study. So I'll just read you a line from the abstract. There are 3 rates of fertilizer of nitrogen, 0, 60 kilograms per hectare, and 120 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare as cumulative applications. They harvested the crop each year in the winter. Nitrogen did not influence yield. So, you know, here we have a giant green grass that has, you know, it's photosynthesizing, it has rubisco, it needs nitrogen, yet they're not seeing a statistical response of nitrogen to yield, despite nutrient takeoffs that would imply. So here's the annual takeoffs of nitrogen each year. So you'd think that you'd start to see a response of nitrogen fertilizer to these sorts of takeoffs. And so there's a lot of, this is an excellent paper, but there's a lot of reasons why this might be happening. And so it could be that, you know, for instance, they get more nitrogen deposition in England than we do in other areas of the world. So nitrogen deposition could be contributing to the fertilizer requirements of the crop. As was mentioned earlier, it's a perennial, and if you harvest it in the winter, it should have gone through its natural senescence process and be recycling nitrogen each year to use the next growing season. And then there might be other sources of nitrogen. This is a highly managed agricultural soil, so the mining potential in this area could be pretty strong, so maybe the crop is just taking nitrogen from deeper layers in the soil. So what have we seen in the U.S.? Well, we haven't been looking at this very long, but in the U.S. there were some plots established. The earliest ones established were put in 2002, and they were really put in to answer a different question. We had done some computer projections of what miscanthus might yield in the U.S., and the numbers came out pretty high, so we decided to put in some small trials to test those projections. So now those small plots have been sort of commandeered to look at some questions that they're really not designed to do. But so we have these 10 by 10 meter plots, they're small, put in 2002, and we'd sample biomass by hand from these plots five times during the growing season. And we did look at the nitrogen content of that biomass. So I'm just going to show you, I'd like to show you some of the yield data that's been seen since 2004 on some of those sites. So here's in the corner is a little key. DeKalb is the northern site, Urbana is the southern site, and then Dixon Springs, this DXS is the southern site. So at Urbana and Dixon Springs, you know, you see variation in the annual yields that were harvested in December, but they're sort of what you might expect from annual variation in yields, nothing too surprising. But if you look at DeKalb, I mean, yields went up by 2006, then they went way down. Now, if you apply a little nitrogen fertilizer to that in subsequent years. So now we see a statistical response of nitrogen fertilizer, or of yield to nitrogen fertilizer, and this is work that Frank Dolman's done at Illinois. So, you know, we do see statistical responses of yield to nitrogen, just not everywhere. And so what's going on? Well, so as I said, we looked at the nitrogen content of the biomass over the growing season. No shockers here, you know, as this is expressed in percent nitrogen on the y-axis, again, over the growing season, and I just picked a representative year here, and there's miscanthus in blue and switchgrass in orange here. So they have similar nitrogen contents that drop off dramatically between June and August, and this is when the crop is putting on all its biomass, so essentially the nitrogen above ground gets diluted as the crop grows in its exponential growth phase. But then the nitrogen concentrations drop off low, and they stay low for the rest of the year. And so we are starting to understand that nitrogen isn't there anymore, right? But we haven't focused on where it went. So the things that are missing here is to couple, I would highlight that Andy Hegenstaller is going to have a presentation tomorrow talking about nitrogen cycling in a session in the afternoon, where we'll look a little bit closer about where this nitrogen is going. So it could be leaching. I mean, we know nitrogen leaches out of drying biomass. So I don't think we've answered the question of how the nitrogen is cycled. What is apparent is that harvest time is going to have a huge impact. None of these plots were fertilized originally, and I'd just like to show here what would happen if we had harvested at the time of maximum biomass. So here's nitrogen removal in kilograms per hectare on the y-axis, again over the growing season. And I'll use the example of the Urbana location, which was the highest yielding. But if you had harvested that crop in August when the yields were highest, and you know, if you're a grower, you want the most biomass you can get from a plot, right? But if you'd harvested that crop in August, you would have removed almost 300 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen when you didn't put any on. So the idea that you're going to be able to maintain productivity with those sort of nitrogen removal rates in perpetuity is unlikely. Fertilizer would be required. But if you go ahead and wait till the crop senesces and maybe nutrients have cycled, now you're looking at removal rates of around 40 kilograms per hectare. And those are the sort of numbers that might be available for quite a long time on highly productive agricultural soils, or they're numbers that are more realistic when we think about low input systems. There's this trade-off, though, between balancing your nitrogen requirements and losing yield. This is, again, yield, now looking at it over the growing season. No matter where you are, yield drops off during senescence. The leaves fall off. Again, you have nutrient cycling going on. So yield is going to decline. It doesn't decline the same over all locations. Here in southern Illinois, yield is maintained pretty steady. So it's the answer varies depending on where you are. But one conclusion that could be drawn is that nitrogen demands are probably going to be pretty low. But it's going to depend on management and where you are. I think we need some long-term and multi-location, probably large-scale trials to really get at this question. When you go in there and cut things down by hand, it's probably not going to give you the same answer as if you were going through there with commercial sale machinery. And of course, it's a much bigger question than just looking at nitrogen content. Okay, so now I'd like to talk just a little bit about water. And I gotta say that this is work that's from Mark David's group, also at Illinois. So there's a poster on this work today by Corey Mitchell. And then Candace Smith is gonna give a presentation very related to this tomorrow afternoon in room 337. So I'll just try to give some highlights to that. So here is work now that was done on much larger plots. So we're on half-acre plots now, still on highly productive soil in Illinois. Here's soil moisture content on the y-axis, and we have switchgrass, corn, soy, and miscanthus. You can see here when the corn soy was planted. So the thing to notice here is that miscanthus is sucking water at much higher rates than the corn soy or the switchgrass are. Here's the evapotranspiration now averaged over multiple years, showing essentially the same thing. Miscanthus is in the blue bar here. The blue bar is always highest, so miscanthus is transpiring more water from these crops. Now, how does that relate to drainage? Now, the blue bar is always lowest. So if you're thinking about places in the Midwest, Roger Beachy mentioned on Monday morning that there's places that still haven't harvested this year in the upper Midwest because it's been so wet. So if part of the goal of sustainability is to help us control our erosion issues, maybe some of our stream flow issues and associated pollution, reducing stream flow or reducing drainage might be advantageous, and miscanthus could be useful in that regard. It's not surprising that miscanthus would have these attributes. This is looking at greenleaf area over the growing season compared to maize. Miscanthus starts growing a lot earlier than maize. It produces a lot more greenleaf area than maize, and it stays green longer. It's going to use water. So the conclusions that I tentatively draw here is that water use efficient doesn't mean no water required. Miscanthus is a highly efficient C4 crop, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily appropriate for drought-prone areas. I think it's going to be really appropriate for wet areas that need to do something to manage increased rainfall, particularly in the spring and the summer. Tell you, it's really nice when you go out and everybody's starting to plant in June and your crop's already 6 feet tall. All right, so just in conclusion, I think that high yields of Giganteus help minimize the need for land use change when it comes to bioenergy. I think that managed properly, Giganteus N requirements are probably going to be pretty low, likely due to efficient nitrogen cycling. I think this is going to really depend on where you are in the world, though, and if the crop senesces properly before winter comes. And I think that Giganteus seems to use considerable water, but it produces considerable yields, and it may be a useful water management tool. So I'll go ahead and stop there. There's a lot of people's work that went into this presentation, and I never get their name on the abstract when we have to submit the abstract so early. So I've tried to highlight some of those people as I've gone along. But thanks for your attention. I haven't had the luxury of worrying about establishment in very wet soils so far. I'm working now in Iowa, at Iowa State. My fields often are they're somewhat poorly drained or just poorly drained, and water stands, and the crop loves that. I haven't had any problem with establishment. In fact, usually getting enough water on during establishment has been a bigger issue. Yeah, I had actually a slide on that because this is the issue that comes up all the time, right? Is that miscanthus and these C4 crops have a lot of the attributes that make a really good weed, and we want highly productive crops. We just want them to stay where we put them, and I think that is one of the advantages of Giganteus at this time is that because it doesn't produce seed, it has one of those modes of reproduction knocked out. So it's not saying it completely mitigates risk, but the studies that have been around so far haven't shown Giganteus to spread. Its rhizome structure is quite different from that of some of its relatives. The rhizomes move quite slowly, and again, it doesn't have seed. So Giganteus, I think, is a safe bet for invasive. Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but in Iowa, there's complete ditches that are full of Saccharophloris. And Saccharophloris is one of the parents of Giganteus. It also doesn't seem to be moving by seed. It has beautiful, showy flower heads, but the way it spreads would imply that it's moving all vegetatively. So I think the answer is we need to do a better job of developing some evaluation practices. There's not really good guidelines for the commercial industry to follow in evaluating invasive potential, so I think we need to help them with that.
One more question, it's a quick one.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, how much of a role do you think your inherent soil fertility and high organic matter levels that you have in your soil is playing a role in the yields that you're seeing?
That's a good question. So I think it's important to have water holding capacity, to be honest. So the areas that we've seen, we've had trials on sandy soils, you know, litter box soils, and areas where there's a heavy clay layer or a plow pan layer as well. So just some really bad soils. And it seems like water and during the establishment time is what really controls things. For instance, the sandy soil was dry, had bad weed problems. But over time, the yields have come right back up and are looking quite nice. So it seems like it's really controlled by water more than inherent soil fertility. But I'm out on a limb there. I mean, it's open for discussion.